Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is RX, who grew up in Vegas, was a 21-year-old dealer, has been APing for more than 15 years, and ran her own RX team. Currently, she's juggling being an AP with being a mom. RX, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi.
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 Now, RX seems, did you go to pharmacy school, or were you in love with an Acura at one point?
No, I was playing poker, and somebody mistook me for somebody else with the initials RX, and I just ran with it. So I've been doing that in the poker room for over a decade.
So, well, how can you have a last name starting with X?
Yeah, right. And not be Chinese.
It's possible.
I figure Xavier. That's all I can think of.
Good. So you, for the record, folks, she does not look Chinese. Now, you've been a female AP for a long time. Mm-hmm. So take about 3 to 5 minutes. And how'd you get started?
I was 21 and I started dealing because I dropped out of college and I wasn't going anywhere. And my mom was a dealer, so my parents thought it was a good idea, and my mom taught me on our kitchen table. So I went to Boulder City, and I got a job at the Hacienda Casino. They hired me with no experience. So I started dealing, and then a couple months later, I moved to the Monte Carlo, and for whatever reason, I learned basic strategy. I was just interested. And then I started poking around online, and I found BJ21.com, and they talked about card counting. And I remembered when I was in high school, my mother told me I would be good at this because she was a dealer at the Horseshoe, and they were always kicking people out for card counting. Now I'm like 16, 17, and my mother's telling me this, which is a little weird, but I remembered it. So at the same time I was looking up stuff on BJ21, there was a guy at my job, and he was a dealer. And he gave us 2 weeks' notice. So his name was Marlon. And I'm only saying his name because he might listen to this show. So Marlon quit his job to, this is a quote, he quit his job to play poker and count cards in Laughlin. So where am I going with this? So
if Marlon's a big guy, he might still be around and I might know him.
Yes, you probably do. He is a big guy and he might listen to this. So anyway, Marlon planted the seed in my head. If Marlon could do it, I could do it. So I got really into it. I got really obsessed with counting cards, and I got Blackjack for Blood, and I learned AO2, and that's what started me down this road.
You know, I want to, last week, somebody had sent in a question. We had a email questions from listeners last week. Mm-hmm. And somebody was asking me, I've always said that I thought dealing really helped me as a player because I felt like I saw heat coming before a lot of other people might, just because I had the experience working in the pit. I'm wondering if you felt the same way, if the dealing helped you.
I don't think so. Nobody was sharp that dealt. Nobody cared. It was, they were pumping cards. They hated their job. I do remember two instances where there was one woman, and she was teaching me how to deal double deck. And she told me not to turn my back, you know, on players when you're dealing to third, and don't turn your back on first base because you can have an entire table taking advantage of you and you don't even know it. And I didn't think much of it at that time, but she obviously knew what was going on. And then once I was shuffling and I exposed the back card, and this floorman came over, the only floorman that was sharp. And he said, if you expose that card, someone's going to see it and they're going to take advantage of you. And I'm like, what is he talking about, right? So besides those two people, nobody had a clue. Nobody cared. Nobody cared.
No, what I'm talking about is a lot of card counters get super paranoid
anytime the phone rings
in the pit. And I just know from my experience, a lot of times it's
nothing.
Bosses talking about where they're going to go after work.
I agree with you. And the bosses would get mad if they were losing, if their table was losing. So sometimes the heat, you think it's heat, but they're just mad that you're winning. They take it personally. I don't know why. There's actually, I know of one place where the floor people actually make more money if their tables make more money, which is absolutely ridiculous, but it happens. I know for a fact it happens.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's dumb.
So while you're being a female AP, starting out at least in blackjack, do you ever have any problems getting the money down because they're not expecting that out of women?
Especially when you were young.
Yeah, I got carded for like the first decade. I looked really young and I couldn't get money down. I've probably bet with someone else calling the plays on a table less than 10 times in my entire career because it just looks ridiculous. But it's not so much because I'm a woman. It's more because I'm not Asian. Because I've played with Asian women that can just fire. They can get action down. They can get more action down on some games than like white males. So it's more because I'm not Asian, I think.
So mostly you would read?
I would read. I would do other things that I would control the table mostly, doing whatever we were doing. And it was better. Like I was good at my job and it helped that I was a female because I would sit there, I would bet minimum. I would have my beer bottle with water in it. And nobody expected me to be smart enough maybe to do anything. So I got away with a lot of stuff.
Even though you weren't blonde, they still thought you were dumb?
Sometimes I was blonde.
Oh.
Yeah.
What about when you started out and you were first counting?
You know, I was very aggressive. And there wasn't as much heat and there was not 6 to 5 yet. And I would fire. I would just bet like crazy. I remember I was making a lot of money. At this point, I moved to Palm Springs and I was dealing and you kept your own tips. So it was a 6-figure job. I was making a lot of money. And when I was counting, I just had no fear. I used to bet black like no problem. And I ran really well. And I might have gotten chased out of a few places, but it wasn't anything serious like later on in my career when it became more advanced stuff and the heat was more.
And how did you go from counting cards to more advanced stuff?
Well, on BJ21, I haven't been on the site for a while, but people were pretty generous with information. And there was talk about hole carding, which seemed really hard and really impossible to find a dealer that would show their hole card. And I was card counting, and I'd made some friends from BJ21, and I met them in real life. So one of these friends that a lot of old school players will know is El Burrow. And El Burrow was a counter, and he had turned into a hole carder. And he took me to the horseshoe one day, and he had me stand behind a table, and he said, just look. So I looked, and this dealer at the horseshoe flashed her entire card to center field, and I was like, oh, my God. Like, the heavens opened up. I couldn't believe it. And there was actually a player there, Crazy Pete, that some people will remember.
And he's still around.
Yeah, I'm sure. And Crazy Pete was sitting in center field, and he looked and he glared at us, and I didn't know who he was. And Alberto's like, we got to go. But just seeing it, knowing that it was possible, I just started scouting like crazy. I would work in Palm Springs for 5 days. After swing shift, I would drive to Vegas. I would hardly sleep. I would work for 2 days. And then I'd drive back. And I did that for like a year.
And I assume you started making way more money playing and you had to quit the job?
I don't know. I made a lot dealing, but I hated it. It sucked. So I didn't obviously quit my job until I learned how to hole card and I had an inventory of games. I wouldn't recommend anybody quit their job to count cards. At least definitely not now. I'm sure someone out there is like crushing counting cards. There's always somebody, but I definitely wouldn't recommend it. And so I waited till I was more advanced and then I quit my job.
You mentioned you were a non-Asian, which gave you problems. Mm-hmm. But you were still a female.
Mm-hmm.
So were the pluses outweigh the non-Asian problems?
It was hard to play by myself without a partner or a crew. Because I couldn't get money down, it was very rare that I could get information and bet the money. It was not rare to be the dumb girlfriend of the bettor and get an extra spot of action down. That's not rare, but to just bet myself and fire, I mean, I've done it, but I've been successful, but I haven't done it much. So definitely because I'm female, but the plus side is nobody thinks I'm ever up to anything. And when I've been caught and backroomed, the way that they talk to me, security or whoever, they never think I'm the brains behind anything. They just think I kind of fell into a bad crew and they turned me in. And nobody ever thinks I'm capable of anything. So it's probably more plus.
One time, you were, that I find this part fascinating. Mm-hmm. Playing at Planet Hollywood, mm-hmm. doing something, Bob Nersesian came to get you out of a situation, mm-hmm. and they threatened to 86 Bob Nersesian if he didn't leave immediately. I want to hear more about that story.
I was doing something that is not illegal. I've never done anything illegal. It's not necessary. You don't need to even be in the gray area to make money. But doing something, and I get recognized, and I get backroomed. And my crew knows I'm backroomed. I think somebody saw me from a distance. So they call Bob immediately. Bob, my savior, who's helped me out of so many situations. And Bob races down to Planet Hollywood, and I can hear him in the next room arguing for my release. And the head of security is in the room with me, and he tells his underling, if he doesn't leave, we'll trespass him. So Bob leaves. And then I'm back there for like 8 hours, handcuffed at Planet Hollywood.
8 hours?
8 hours. They bring in detectives. They thought they were bringing down this massive operation. And it was funny because the cop was a moron. And after Bob left, he said to me, I know your lawyer is the leader of this operation. Otherwise, he would not have come down here to get you out. And then he said, what kind of car does he drive? And this guy was dead serious. And I was just like, you're a moron. So I'm not answering anything for 8 hours. They have my name. They're asking me questions. And I say, you know, I prefer not to answer. And they think this is so cute because people usually say I plead the fifth. So I'm not rude to them. I'm just accepting the situation. And by the time they let me out of the back room and ended up taking me to jail, everyone back there, the head of security, the security guards were like, you know, good luck. I hope it works out for you. They really felt like I just got into a bad situation. They had no idea that I actually was knowledgeable about anything. So they charged me with 6 felonies. I didn't do anything illegal. I have to keep saying that. But it's hard to talk yourself out of something when they think they hit a jackpot. So basically, they took me to jail, and this is kind of funny. My bail was $60,000. It was $10,000 for each felony. So I'm in jail, and it's all these hookers and me, and then a couple girls for domestic violence, but mostly hookers. And so I thought you didn't ask anybody what you did when you're in jail. I thought that was like a no-no. And everybody asked you, what did you do? And how much is your bail? So everybody was a hooker, and they got charged with trespassing, and their bail was like $1,500.
So the charge was trespassing, not soliciting or prostitution or whatever.
They said trespassing. That was what they were. And I was in there for a while, and we were talking. I learned a lot. But so they asked me, and I said, trespassing, what's your bail? $2,000. So meanwhile, it's $60,000, right? So they put us in this cell, and it's probably like 15 people were supposed to be in the cell, and there was like 25 of us. And everybody was so nice, and they were making room on benches so everybody could sit down, and they were telling stories. I mean, these women were nice. These were very nice women. And
As hookers go,
they were so nice.
Wait, I'm curious about the domestic violence. You mean these were women who were doing the violence?
There was one girl in there. She beat up her brother's girlfriend.
Oh.
And there was one girl in there, and she had stolen a sandwich. And the lady that owned the shop where she stole the sandwich chased her down, and she got arrested. And this girl was in this little cell for 3 days, and she was crying because she missed her girlfriend, this woman. And everybody felt so bad for her, and they're consoling her. These were not the worst people to be around in this situation. The guards were not nice. They treated you like dirt, like you were guilty no matter what. And some of these girls had been in jail. This was just what they did, like, once a month they're there, and some of the guards know these hookers, but they still treat them like dirt, which is whatever. But so I went to jail, and somebody posted my bail the next morning, $60,000. And I got out, and then I had to fight it, and it cost money to fight it. I got off, obviously, because I didn't do anything illegal. But yeah, I took time
off
of work.
That's not so obvious, by the way.
It's not. Try talking your way out of it. It's just not. And I had to fight it, and I ended up getting off.
Now, Bob has had in the past some big settlements for mm-hmm. their clients being backroomed for 8 hours. Was there any of that involved?
No, there wasn't really anything to go for, or it wouldn't have been worth much. And I had to get another lawyer because Bob is a civil attorney, and I had to get a criminal lawyer. I wanted Bob to take the case, and he actually said he would, but he had never done criminal, and I thought maybe I should go with somebody else, and he was no Bob, but, you know, I got off.
But he didn't think that there was a civil case to be had.
Right. Bob didn't. I went over everything with Bob, and he just didn't think that it was worth it.
So you've had a number of cases with Bob.
I have. Bob has saved me so many times.
So one actually that we can talk about that Bob has talked about on the show was mm-hmm. you had like a rather bad situation coming from Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
With money?
Yeah.
You want to tell us about that one?
Yeah. My partner at the time, this was 2006, and my partner was also my boyfriend. So we started in Vegas, where we both live, with like $40K bankroll. And we fly to Atlantic City to work. And I think we win like $20K. So now we fly to Puerto Rico for half vacation, half work. So we do really well in Puerto Rico, and we win like $40K. So now we have $100,000 on us. No big deal. It's no big deal. I've traveled with money, not a problem. So we're going through the airport in Puerto Rico, and they do a random search on my bag, and they see $35,000. So they bring me into a back room. Jesus, my partner, my boyfriend, doesn't say a word. He's very smart. He doesn't talk. Me, on the other hand, I'm naive, and I'm like, if I explain it, it's no problem. So I tell them we were gambling and we won money. And so the TSA agent says, if you're lying to me, I'll extradite you back here. And don't be surprised if somebody at your destination wants to talk to you about it. Okay, fine. So they let us go. So now we're on the flight. So I call Bob immediately. I'm like, Bob, they're going to take us in Vegas and they're going to try to talk to us. Can you meet us at the gate? And we're landing at like midnight. And he's like, no problem. Me and Thea, his wife, also a lawyer, will be there. Bob. The greatest. So we also have on us about 5 or 6 IDs. They're alias IDs. They're for gambling. They are not illegal at all. You can look up the law. I won't explain it. But I know that if we have to talk our way out of this, it's not going to work. We're going to jail for sure. So I call my friend that lives in Georgia while we're taking off and I say, meet us at the airport and you need to take these from us because we think we're going to go to Vegas and get detained or something. So we land in Georgia, Atlanta, and my friend is there, and he goes in the bathroom with Jesus, and he takes these IDs. Cool. Jesus walks out, I'm getting a cup of coffee, and my phone rings. And some people at this point know where this is going. We didn't. So my phone rings, it's my friend. And before I can say anything, I'm surrounded by the DEA. So I hang up. Later on, we realize he called to take our money. Why don't you give me all your money? So at this point, they don't know Jesus has 65K on him. They just know about my 35K. So Jesus could have given him the 65K, or could have given him the 100. Like, what are they going to do? I don't have money on me. Is that illegal? Like, what can you possibly do to me? So we just didn't think of it, which I think now looking back was really stupid. So the DEA, Jesus again doesn't answer any questions. He gives his ID and that's it. Me, on the other hand, I'm like, this is our trip log, and here are our receipts, and we're professional gamblers, and they're taking our money no matter what. They're taking it. So we put it in plastic baggies. They're holding the plane up while we do this because they want us to get out of Georgia. They take all of our money, every single cent. We're not allowed to count it. We put it in plastic bags, and we write on the bag how much we have. I write 35K and change, and he writes 65K. So we get back to Vegas. Bob and Thea are at our gate. Their fires are burning. They're ready to tackle whatever is going on. And nobody's there. Nobody cares. They have our money. They keep our bags overnight. And then the next day, they deliver them to Bob's office. So we fax in our tax returns where we claim gambling winnings. We fax in our IDs again, my trip logs, a letter from my CPA saying, I know this person is a gambler. We fax in whatever we can think of. And they say, no, we're not giving you your money back. So about 3 months goes by, and Bob's still working on this. And they say, okay, if you take a lie detector test and pass, we will give you your money back. And it's like, fuck you, no. Like, you're not free rolling me. That's no. So a couple more months goes by, and they say, okay, if you sign something saying you won't sue, we will give you your money back. And again, it's like, no, that's not happening. A couple more months goes by, and it lands on the desk of some higher up, not the DEA. I'm not sure who. But she realizes that the agent had lied in his report. He had said that we gave fake or false information in Georgia, which Jesus didn't say a word. I for sure didn't lie about anything. So finally, she gives our money back, and immediately we sue. We sue the agent because we can't sue the DEA. They have immunity of some sort. So we file suit in Nevada, and Nevada kicks it out of the lower court. We appeal to the Ninth Circuit. I'm going to try to, I don't want to bore anyone. I'm going to try to wind this down.
I don't think our audience is bored, by the way.
Okay, yeah, so. I don't think so. But also, I mean, they were trying to make you sue in Georgia.
Basically,
that was part of what this case was about.
Basically, the Ninth Circuit said, yes, you can sue in Nevada. And we wanted to sue in Nevada because it's easier for us. And the money stolen impacted Nevada. We couldn't do business with it in Nevada. We're residents of Nevada. So basically, the Ninth Circuit twice said, yes, you can sue Nevada. So he appeals to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, I don't know, they get 8,000 to 10,000 appeals a year, and they hear 100, maybe. And they take our case, which is shocking. And so, so now we have to go to the Supreme Court and fight this thing, just so we can sue in Nevada. It's not even about them stealing our money at this point. We just want to sue in Nevada. So this is my biggest regret about this whole thing. There's a lawyer named Tom Goldstein, and he's very successful, and he's tried cases at the Supreme Court many times, a dozen times, and he plays poker, and he's friends with Jesus, and he wants to take our case pro bono. And it's like, awesome, here's the most successful like Supreme Court lawyer, and he wants to do it for free. Awesome. And here's Bob, who's gotten me out of I don't even know how many situations in my life. And he got our money back, and he's taken us this far. And I'm so self-involved that I don't even think about giving the case to Bob. I'm just like, yeah, Tom can take it. And Tom's a super nice guy, and he did a great job. But that was Bob's case. Like, Bob should have argued that case. That's kind of a thing. You're a lawyer. You want to go to the Supreme Court. I have total faith in Bob and Thea. So they were co-counsel to Tom, but I feel bad that I didn't just say, no, there's no way. This is Bob's case. And I even apologized to him like 6 months ago, because I didn't even think about this till I was writing a book and I read it back and I was like, wow, you're an asshole. That was Bob's case, right? So Tom argues the case.
I don't think Bob's carrying that around with him.
No, he didn't care. At least he doesn't care now. And I said to him, did you care at that time? And he said, yeah, I would have liked to, but I couldn't sway you. And I was like, Bob, I wish you would have like just said something, because I was self-involved. I didn't even think about it. So, but he went to DC with Thea and Tom did the oral argument, and he crushed it. He was so good. And he argued that if somebody steals your, I'm going to like dumb it down, but if somebody steals your identification and does something with it in Georgia and you live in Nevada, do you really have to fight it in Georgia? Should you be burdened with that? Shouldn't you be able to fight it in Nevada? And I thought it was a good argument. They didn't buy it. We lost. So at this point, we have to file suit in Georgia. So Jesus is over it. He's totally over it. And I'm like, I'm still upset. You just can't steal someone's money. So Jesus is like, if you find a lawyer, you know, I'll take half the action. We can go forward with it. So I call like 12 lawyers in Georgia. Nobody wants to take it because we got our money back. Like, what's there to fight about? And I found one lawyer, and he wasn't cheap. And he said, if we file suit, they're going to kick it out and say the statute of limitations is up. So I'm like, how can that be? It was in the courts for 8 years. He said, that's what they're going to do. And then we have to prove that it's not up. So even getting to file the suit was going to cost a decent amount of money. So I gave it up. I just let it go. And so we never got to sue about it. And the reason I wanted to sue was not so much, I wanted my money back that we paid to get the $100,000 back that we paid Bob. But I wanted to set a precedent in a lower court that said the government can't steal your money. So next time it happened to someone, they could cite this case and say, well, this happened, you can't steal my money. And we didn't get to do that. And now maybe one of you guys know there's a new standard about this. They implemented something.
Well, I know under Obama they were scaling back on these forfeitures. But now under Jeff Sessions, mm-hmm. he wants to ramp them back up.
Right.
So, yeah.
I think before it was kind of an unspoken rule that you could steal from people, and now it's maybe written rule that you can steal from people, something like that. So we didn't pursue it, and now it's over.
Yeah, what a nightmare.
It's maddening. I mean, that guy, they straight stole our money. That was it. And imagine if I had, like, a drug misdemeanor conviction from when I was a teenager or something stupid. They would have just kept it. They would have said she has a history of drug, because that's what they said. It was drug money.
Of course.
Yeah. Right. So if I had a history, even the smallest thing, they would have kept it for sure.
Yeah.
So.
All right. We're talking to RX. We're about halfway through, and we're going to sneak in some commercials at this point. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. Each Monday through Thursday in August, there's a gift giveaway related to the inaugural South Point 400 at the Las Vegas Motor Speedway on September 16th. The gift for next week is a polo shirt saying South Point 400. Go figure. The South Point 400 itself is the first race in the NASCAR Cup Series playoffs and will be held September 16th. It is the round of 16 drivers. You may purchase half-price tickets using your slot club points at the casino box office. There's also a weekend free play email blast. If you aren't getting it already, you're probably not going to. If they have your email, you get so much money on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday where you play enough and they give you some email. They do this 3 or 4 times a year. It is worth giving them your email address, especially if you are here regularly on weekends. The size of your email blast is correlated with the size of your mailer. If you get the top mailer, you're getting an extra $150 a week in the email. If you get lower mailers, you're getting less than that. The 8th class and the free video poker series will be Tuesday, August 21st at noon in the Silverado Lounge. The class is NSU Deuces Wild. NSU is a go-to game for a lot of players there. It's a 99.7 game, which makes it even, but with a 0.3 slot club, it's pretty much straight up. Playing an even game and taking advantage of the mailers and promotion gives the players a small edge. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, you get corrections on many of the games. The game of the week is Max Action Poker, where you pay 6 to 10 coins per line and all the pay schedule categories from 3 of a kind or higher are bumped. You get a more valuable game the more coins you play. You also get more variants. It will require learning a completely new strategy, and since flushes and straights pay so much more than what you're used to, your intuition will be way off on how to play the hands. The highest returning games are in the 98.8% range, which is not very attractive. But the games will overhold so much that perhaps the Theo offered by the casino will make the game worthwhile. You'll have to check this out for yourself wherever you're finding the game. All right, we've been talking to RX. We've so far talked mainly about blackjack. Mm-hmm. You've also played some poker, including some high-stakes poker in Vegas. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I was involved in 2 high-stakes games in Vegas that are well-known. The first, I switched over to No Limit. I played Limit for a long time. I switched over to No Limit Poker in 2008, 2009. So I'm playing about 5-10 No Limit for a couple years. And so it's 2010. I'm playing 5-10 at one of my favorite rooms. And everyone's sitting with 2K, 2,500, that's the stack size. And this guy walks in, and he puts down $150,000, and nobody's ever seen him before. So we're like, oh, who's this guy? And he's in a hand.
On a 5-10 game.
On a 5-10 game. He comes from the pit where we learn later he bets 3 by 15K is his normal bet. So he's a whale. So he saw it on TV, he wanted to give it a try. So he sits down, and he sits down to my right, and he gets in a hand, and he says to the dealer, does a flush beat a straight, or does a straight beat a flush? He has no idea. So the dealer can't tell him.
Is this playing games, or is he...
No, he's for real. This is very real.
Uh-huh.
So the dealer can't tell him, and the hand's over, and I tell him, you know, a flush beats a straight, and nobody cares that I just told him this. Everyone's, like, super excited. So he doesn't realize you can call $10 to enter the pot, or you can fold. So every hand is 200 to go, 200, 200, two black chips. And everybody runs to their safety deposit box or their friends, and they get as much cash as they can, right? So I put on 30K, and then now the stacks at the table are like 10 to 50K. So I'm sitting with 30K, and he's chatting with me, and I look like his niece, his favorite niece from this foreign country, and he's super nice guy. And so we get in a pot, he makes it 200, and we're playing 5-10, so... It takes a lot of raises to get the money in the middle, but basically he makes it 200, I 3-bet, someone 4-bets, he calls, I 5-bet, someone 6-bet shoves 50K. He can't wait to get his money in, he was so excited. So I call off my 30K with aces, and the other guy is kings, the regular, and this guy is jack 4, and he is so excited. So it's like,
oh man,
this is my biggest pot that I've ever played. So it comes king high flop, blank, blank, I lose. He loses, the other guy wins. And this is the biggest pot I've lost at this point. So this guy feels so bad for me. He's just, I can't believe you lost. You had aces. How did you not win? I'm so sorry. And he doesn't even care about his jack four. He doesn't care. So he's tired of playing. He wants to go back to the pit. He says, take my number. Come party with us tomorrow. And of course, I want to play again. So yeah, give me your number. So the next night... And I also want to see how he parties. I mean, this guy is like a whale, right? So the next night, I go to a suite with my boyfriend at the time, who was also in the game the night before, and a friend of ours who was also in the game the night before. And he's so happy to see us, like, come in, and he's so nice, and all of his friends. Everybody's on drugs. Everybody's super high. And so we're in this suite, like the biggest suite ever. And then we go to the club, and we get, like, the best tables, you know, the whole thing. And so he says, I want to play again. I would love to play with you guys. I'll call you when I come into town after the new year. This was December 2010. So basically for the next year and a half, the same six players, me included, play with this guy. Let's call him Omar. I have to give him a name. It just makes it easier. So Omar calls us for the next year and a half, and he just wants to play with us. He likes playing with us. He likes it. So other players in Vegas were not happy that they couldn't get in games with Omar. And we'd sneak around. We'd go play at the Palms, or we'd play at the Mirage, where nobody could see us because the games that they have there are like 1-2 no limit. So for a year and a half, we play 5-10 no limit, and the buy-in gets higher and higher and higher because he loses. He didn't win one session in a year and a half. This is not a lie. He went broke every session. There was one session where he was up like 60K. Every session was at least 24 hours. So we're playing 24 hours. He's up 60,000. He's having a great time because he's winning the first time ever. And he's tired. So all seven of us go take a nap in his suite. And then we wake up and we play again and he loses it all. So he never won a session in a year and a half. And the first 3 months, no exaggeration, he didn't know what he had. He couldn't read his hand. So we would help him. And he was always on drugs. I mean, it was just, the situation was ridiculous. So we're playing 5-10, and the buy-in goes from 10,000 to 20,000 to 50,000 to 100,000. As he loses more and more, the buy-in gets bigger, but the blinds never change. So we're playing with 100K stacks, 5-10 blinds.
Oh, man.
It was crazy. And some people in the community thought we were just chopping him up, like we were basically all in on it together, but we weren't, and that wasn't necessary. He wasn't good. And the way the game played was he'd raise 100% of the time. He was in every pot. He'd make it 200, and somebody would isolate him, and it would be heads up. And that's how the game played. That's just how it went. And so we weren't really playing against each other, but it's not because we were in on it. It's just that's just not how the game played. So, and when he'd go on tilt, when he was down to like his last 25K, he'd just shove it. Every hand, he'd shove it. So whatever he had. So you would limp your $10. It would get to him. He'd shove 25K and you'd flip with him. And that's the game. So after a year and a half, he lost a few million dollars. Everybody won a lot of money. And he kind of, yeah, he kind of disappeared for a while. And then I heard he was playing in California and the blinds got bigger, like 200, 400 maybe. And they were still playing 100K, which now the game is a little different when the blinds are bigger. And there were some like no limit specialists now playing with him. So I wasn't going to go to California and chase him around. It was, we were done. So now we're in 2011, I guess. No, we're in 2012. And the World Series comes around, and the cash games are really good. So now I'm playing higher than before this Omar game. I'm playing 2550. I'm playing 510, 1020, 2550. And I win 100K in 2 months. Like, I'm just on fire. So it winds down, and now it's August. And now I'm at the Aria playing 1020. And there's a guy in my game, and he's just hanging out until the private game in the Ivy Room starts. And the private game is 200, 400, no limit, 50K buy-in.
Wait, I didn't think they were allowed to have private games.
Yeah, this is a big argument in the poker community. People, the Aria says, no, it's not private, but poker pros can't get in. It was private. Whatever they say, it was a private game. You were not getting in. How they get around it, I don't know. Bobby Baldwin plays in the game. I'm sure that helps. So it's a private game, and I asked this guy, do you think I can get a seat? And I'm half joking because there's no way I'm getting a seat. So he comes out 10 minutes later. I got you a seat. I have half your action. Okay, cool. This game is supposed to be awesome, right? So the reason I got a seat is because later on that night, there was $1 million buy-in no limit game starting. And some of the people in the 200, 400 were going to play that. So there were actually a couple seats available. Oh, sorry. So this guy gets me in the game. He takes half my action. I buy in 50,000. We're playing like five or six handed. And there's a guy in the game that was waiting for the $1 million buy-in game. So he's just playing this game for fun. So my very first hand, I'm not going to like get deep into hand histories, but my very first hand I raise, I don't, 900, 1,000, I don't know, with ace king. This guy makes it 4,000. So it gets back to me, and this guy just wants to gamble. I mean, I can't shove. That's absolutely ridiculous. But I'm not going to call. And if I, so I raise it to 15,000, which is also, you know, ridiculous. But he's not just going to call 11,000 and play, and he's not going to fold, so I know he's shoving. So I make it 15K, he shoves, I call 50K, I have ace king, he has ace nine, he wins. So I buy in another 50K. Two hands later, I have jacks. I raise, he re-raises me, I make it 15, he shoves, I call, 100K pot. I have jacks, he has fours, he wins. So now Jesus. I'm down 100, and the guy who has half my action is in the game. And this is not a secret, this is not shady, everybody knows this. So this guy's very annoyed. So about 45 minutes goes by. My last buy-in, I turn it into about 80K. Heads up with the same guy. We're on the turn. I have top pair, flush draw, straight draw. He has bottom pair with a gut shot. We get all the money in, so it's like 170, the pot. He wins. So this sucks, right? So I'm out of money. I leave. He's having a good time. The guy that had half of me is very, very not happy. So anyway, so for the next 10 months or so, I get to continue playing in the game. And it's not because I was a fish. It's because this guy that got me the seat just lost 75,000. And he's not getting that money back unless I play in this game. So he gets me the seat as much as he can, which is like maybe once a week, twice a week, or just not that week at all. So I play sporadically for, I don't know, 10 months or something. Maybe 20 times. I don't know. But I lose another 300, 325 in this game. So in the next 10 months, not counting the 150 I just dropped. So I lose like 450, 475. And it's a big loss, right? But sometimes the buy-in was 100,000, sometimes it was 50,000. So in relation to the buy-in, I lost, you know, five buy-ins or whatever. I thought I was going to win $1 million, but I didn't. And also this game was way too big for me to be playing. Even if I'm buying in half of whatever the buy-in is, like, I have no business in this game. But, you know, I kept playing because it was a good game and I want my money back and blah blah blah. So the game didn't break me. It didn't hurt my poker ego, but emotionally and mentally it hurt, but not financially. I was still okay. So going back to the Planet Hollywood story, that happened right after this, and on top of that, I made bad life investments. And on top of that, the legal fees on my team at that point broke up. So a lot of things happened at the same time. So it definitely, it was downhill from there. That was not a good time.
Now, actually, so let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. You talk about being down close to half mil, only half of it is yours, but still, that would be a rocky road to a lot of players.
Oh, yeah, it sucked.
Now, for APs just getting started, how did you manage to survive these speed bumps? That was a pretty significant one.
Yeah, it wasn't just the poker loss, too. It sounds like there was a lot of crap going on all at the same time.
It was real life that got me. The poker loss, you know, did not help, but it was... But, you know, I had done well in the Omar game and the World Series cash games, and I still had a team, and it didn't bust me, but life, you know, got me there. So there's obvious things to keep you successful. There's bankroll management. Is obvious. If you don't practice good bankroll management, you'll probably go broke. I'm all for taking shots. Anybody that knows me knows I'll take shots. But if every day you're taking a shot, it's not a shot. You're just playing over your bankroll. So there's that.
We're taking a shot means it's bigger than you can normally afford, but you have a significant advantage,
yes.
You feel.
Mm-hmm.
And you're...
Well, yeah, you did that, Bob, with the million-dollar video poker, right?
I mean, more than once, and I had positive variance there.
Yeah.
And, okay.
And then there's adapting. You have to always adapt to the conditions. I learned how to count, and then I learned how to hole card. So I never would have been able to quit my job if not for that. And then as competition grows or games disappear, I had to learn other things, or I had to learn a lot of other things to survive 15 years. And so there's that. And
the other thing you had going for you is you're a really hard worker.
Oh, yeah, I work super hard. I'm a workaholic for sure. Yeah, I could go three shifts in a row, no problem. But it's also, I've surrounded myself with good people. It's definitely quality over quantity for me. Like, I'm involved. I've met great people, and they've helped me out with information or just with information. And then at this point, and people don't like to talk about this, but after losing at the Aria and then the legal bills and just everything happening, bad investments, I was broke. I had no money to work. I had assets, I had a house, I had a car, I had a few other things, but I didn't have enough money to work the way I needed to work. And so at this point, multiple people, more than one person stepped up and gave me money. And it was so appreciated. More than one person said, here's a significant amount of money, you know, go do what you do. Nobody asked me what my plan was. Nobody made me explain myself. They didn't charge me juice. They didn't say pay me back by this day or make payments. They just, here's some money, go do what you do. And so I think people trusted me, but they were quality people that I had relationships with. And people don't like to talk about going broke or, you know, borrowing money. It sucks. But more than one person did that. And then on top of that, people gave me information. Like, hey, there's games here, or let me show you this new move, or, you know, whatever. So that helped me stay in the game, because I would have had to, like, sell my house, I guess, if I needed the money. So, yeah, so that's another thing that's exclusive to me, maybe. I mean, it's my fault that I made bad investments, but that helped out.
All right. You've had some run-ins with law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Some you've told us today haven't been all that much fun.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there was one in small town Louisiana that was a bit different. What happened there?
Yeah, we were in Nowhere, Louisiana, and I was with my team. And I guess the casino thought something was going on, and I was in the high limit room with two teammates. We were kind of setting up. And one of my teammates I could see outside on the main floor. And I looked, and he was in handcuffs. And he's waving his hands behind his back as much as he could to let me know, hey, you know, I'm in handcuffs. So I give the signal to my other two teammates, like, you know, get the fuck out. And so we all scatter. We all run. I get caught before I can make it to the door. The other two make it to the parking lot. The guy He's a Vietnamese guy. He goes to his car, which I don't think was a good idea, but they got him while he was in his car. And the other girl made it to a convenience store. She got a ride with some locals, and they brought her to a motel, and she was safe. So she lets everybody know. Well, actually, she does, but I'm in handcuffs, and I'm fortunate to be wearing a jacket with a pocket in the back. And so I get out a text to Jesus, and I say the name of the casino, handcuffs, call Bob. Here's Bob again. So
I got a feeling she's not talking about me.
So there's three of us, me, a white guy, and a Vietnamese guy in handcuffs on the floor of a hallway in the back. And I can hear the security in their office say they called their damn lawyer, because Bob calls right away, right, to try to get our release because he's the best. So the sheriff comes in, the sheriff of this little town, and he walks in. And he looks at us, and he rolls his eyes and says, get them out of those handcuffs. So then he takes us into a back shed or whatever it was. And he questions us. He takes us one at a time.
Shed?
It was very odd.
A shed in Louisiana, man. Yeah, I would expect the chainsaws to be coming or something.
And I'm expecting this guy to have a very small mind and not be very nice to us. And this has been my experience with law enforcement. They're just not nice to you. So we're back here, and I give my name, and I won't say anything else. And then the white guy that I'm with gives his name. He won't say anything else. They don't question the Vietnamese guy because he looks so sad. This was his first experience. He looked so sad, and he's not reacting to their questions. And so they don't think he can speak English. Like, that's what I got. They don't question him. He's just sitting there. So the sheriff says, you know, you were passing signals and that's illegal. And now I know that's not illegal. So I said, I'd like to speak to my lawyer. So he lets me call Bob, which was super nice. And he's not being nice to us, but he's not being like a jerk. He's just being reasonable. So I call Bob and I said, will you talk to my lawyer? So this guy talks to Bob. So eventually within an hour, because they can only hold you for an hour, yeah, that's another story. But they hold us.
How did that? I mean, after the plan.
I haven't
Hollywood,
heard of that, Ottawa.
Yeah. Well, we were held for 4 hours in Vegas once. That was I sued the casino, but that's another story. Right now, we're in Louisiana. So after less than an hour, he does his research or whatever, and he says, you know, I don't think you broke the law. I'm going to let you go. Don't come back to this casino and don't come back to this town. Cool. Fine. They let us go. And that was only experience I've had with law enforcement where they were reasonable, and it was randomly in nowhere Louisiana, which I did not expect. And it's not only gambling that I've had difficulty with law enforcement, it's non-gambling stuff. It's not just AP stuff. But yeah, this was the only time where he was reasonable.
Have you had a lot of people have had these problems with driving with cash where you get pulled over for driving exactly the speed limit or something?
Yeah. That's never happened to me, but going back to the one lawyer in Georgia that was willing to take our case against the DEA agent, I was referred to him by another AP who had tens of thousands of dollars in chips confiscated from him in Georgia he was driving. And so this lawyer that I talked to got the money back for this other AP. That's how I got referred, and that's why I thought maybe this guy will take our case. But like I said, it would be
man,
too expensive.
That's really bad if they're going to take chips.
Well, yeah.
Because I mean, there aren't even any casinos in Georgia, so.
It was so stupid. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
At one point, I heard through the grapevine that you were writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still going strong, or has it been moved to some kind of back burner?
I probably shouldn't have announced that so soon. When I was pregnant.
Sounds like a back burner to me.
Yeah. When I was pregnant, I've been writing stuff about my experiences for years. But when I was pregnant, I didn't work. I didn't go in the casino. I took a year off. So I just wrote. And I wrote like 50,000 words of a book, of a memoir. So, and I did it by myself. And I sent it out to about 60 literary agents. And mostly nobody responded. I got a few no's. So I was complaining about it to a friend of mine named Dinky, and some listeners.
Dinky's been on the show.
Oh, has he? Cool. Yeah. So Dinky, obviously he was a main character in Lay the Favorite.
She's been on the show.
Oh, has she? Oh, cool. So, okay. So Dinky's like, you know, call Beth. Beth will help you. Yeah. I didn't know that. I'll have to listen to that.
A very first one.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
Very first show Beth was on.
So I call Beth. I'm like, hey, Beth, will you help me? I had met her before. And she's like, yeah, no problem. I'll help you write a proposal. She's obviously been successful. But, you know, I pay her for her time, obviously. And we work on it, and I send it out. It takes a few months, and I send it out to about 100 agents. And I got one that liked it. I got one that was like, I want to sign you, and he was super excited about it. And he's at, like, a top 10 literary agency. Like, he's the real deal. And he comes from a TV background. So I call him up, and he's like, I love this. This is awesome. You know, we can get a TV series out of this. And he's super stoked. And I'm like, really? And I know that's a long shot to even say, and it sounds a little ridiculous, but he's really into it. So he says, this proposal is not good enough to send to publishers, so do it over. And he gives me a bunch of notes. So I go back to Beth. I'm like, Beth, we have to do it over. I take his notes. You know, I pay her again. It's her time. It's valuable. We do it over. It takes another couple months, and I turn it in, and my agent is like, this is not good enough. Okay, so we interview some writers that do celebrity memoirs, and we interview a few, and I pick one. I pick this woman who's very successful, and at this point, I'm kind of burnt out, so I take a different approach. I give her everything I have. She talks to my agent. My agent gives her notes. She interviews me. She interviews my mom. Like, she's really into it, so of course, I pay her for her time, and she turns it in to the agent and to me, and it was awful. It was so bad. We were upset. My agent was very upset. I was upset. So now it's like, what do you do? So he still believes in it, and he used to work at Showtime, so he really believes, like, maybe this could be a series, and there's so many streaming services. And so I'm not totally, like, dejected, but I'm definitely down. So I find another writer that could help me, and he wants, and I have to pay him, obviously, and he wants basically what I paid the first two writers. And so I'm just, it's like I have PTSD. Like, I can't spend another dollar and then have my agent say, no, this isn't good enough. And I think the guy that I have in my back pocket will be good enough, but man, I just need a break. Like, I just need a break from it for a little bit. This was 6 months ago that this other woman turned in a proposal, and my agent has yet to drop me, so I need a break.
All right. We've been interviewing our ex, and she's dropped a couple teasers. She did mention that she got pregnant. She did mention a Vietnamese guy, and you're going to hear more about them next week. This has been very fascinating to Richard and me, hopefully to you too. And so we have a lot more questions to ask our ex. And we're going to hear about the Vietnamese guy next week, and being an AP while being a mom. It's got to be different.
We should plug her blog before we go.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to – good. It's rxgamble.com,
right?
rxgamble.com. You can find the blog, yeah.
Okay.
There's a lot of things on there, and we're going to talk about some of them. One I just came across. And I told Richard, she didn't even write it, but she posted it. It's about a $21,000 airplane seat.
Oh, yeah, that was cool.
So I showed it yesterday. Well, side story. My wife's relatives were going on a Laughlin River run for $70. You get an inner tube and a bag of chips and something. And Bonnie was saying how expensive that was. I was just going, wait till you see this. So I showed her the thing on the $21,000 airplane seat. If you Google it or go to the rxgamble.com, it is worth the 5 to 8 minutes it takes to watch. It is really clever. So we're going to talk to RX some more next week. Thank you again. Looking forward to this. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.